The Brighton Business Show on Radio Reverb.
Welcome to the Brighton Business Show with Vivian Smith, broadcasting on 97.2 FM.
The Brighton Business Show on Brighton's Radio Reverb.
Today's show is going to feature drink of some kind. And in fact, we're going to be talking about the business of gin. On today's show, our first two guests are Dave Broom, who is a spirits writer. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
And Ellie from Brighton Gin.
Hello.
So let's start off with you, Dave. I mean, a spirits writer, that sounds kind of quite mystical. But I'm taking it you mean the other kind of spirits,
yeah,
do you?
Yeah, I do. I did get into a bit of problem once in Mexico when I said I was a spirits writer. And the girl I was talking to said, oh, do you like peyote? It took about an hour to kind of work out that I was dealing with different sort of spirits. I spend my life writing about booze.
How fantastic. And presumably sampling it as well.
Yes, in a responsible fashion.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, obviously. But yeah, it's just it's an absolutely fascinating area to explore. Yeah. Wine writing is very well established, but spirits writing is actually relatively new. So there's lots of new angles to explore, and this is just a great time to be writing about it because we are in a golden age of distilling.
Absolutely. And I first came across you, I went to a gin tasting, which was rather nice. It was a gin tasting supper. And you told us a bit about, you know, the history of gin. Because gin hasn't always been quite so trendy, has it?
No, it's had this real kind of roller coaster history. You know, I suppose its worst period, it's certainly in the UK, was during the 18th century, during the what was known as the gin craze, where this really poor quality spirit, which was purportedly gin, was being drunk in insane amount of quantities by the poor in London. But it began to revive all the way through the 19th century. It was the first great cocktail spirit at the tail end of the 19th century.
Sure.
It boomed during Prohibition, 1930s. But really, in the 1970s, 1980s, it began to fall from favour again.
Okay.
I remember I was having to desperately try and persuade people to even try gin not that long ago.
Right. It's amazing to think of that now, isn't it?
Yeah, and suddenly, it really almost out of nowhere, it just suddenly caught away and has absolutely taken off. And it shows no sign of slowing.
Ellie, I'm sure that Brighton Gin has a lot to do with that, really.
It's all down to Brighton Gin.
So what about Brighton Gin? I mean, I know that obviously we're a Brighton station, and so we're very, very keen. And Kathy happens to be one of my fellow presenters as well. But Brighton Gin is remarkably popular, and it's getting a really good global name for itself as well, isn't it?
It is. And I think there are lots of reasons for that. I mean, we're really proud of the fact that we live and work in Brighton, and you know, Brighton as a city has, you know, all the people in it have been real ambassadors for Brighton Gin, which we're enormously grateful for and very happy about. But finally, you know, Brighton deserves its own gin. It's amazing, really, to us that it didn't happen before Kath came up with the idea.
Kath
came up with the idea 6 or 7 years ago and approached a few friends and said, nobody's making Brighton gin, let's do it. Who's in? And we all said, oh, that's a good idea. we'd had a few glasses of wine probably at that stage. And here we are 6 years later. Yes.
So, I mean, how was it first of all distilled? Because, I mean, I think, was it a sort of fairly small scale?
Well, the recipe was 2 years in the development, around the kitchen table.
Yes.
I was pregnant for quite a lot of it, so I was quite miffed about
how annoying.
It was extremely annoying.
You could just breathe in the wafts of alcohol,
exactly.
I suppose.
Yeah. Rushing out and buying fire blankets and fire extinguishers, actually, because there was quite a lot of experimenting. My husband is also one of the founding directors of Brighton Gin. He's a physicist by trade.
Right.
So Kat sort of said to him, you know, you're clever, you can build a still. And he was kind of going, I think that's chemistry, but you know, how hard can it be? So there was quite a lot of experimenting around the kitchen table.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, we moved to the basement of a pub in Hove. And now we have a large industrial unit and there are 9 of us, a merry gang, working and producing around Christmas, you know, nearly 1,000 bottles a week. It's
gone
from strength to strength. And yes, exporting now to Denmark and Germany as well, and hoping to increase those exports this year.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not even going to say the B word, but you know what I'm talking about. And we'll see what happens over the next
It'll be fine.
It'll be fine.
And I think it really was a cottage industry to begin with, wasn't it? I think Kathy was talking about her mum pasting on the labels and things like that.
Still, works yeah. for us and still does most of our labelling and waxing.
Excellent.
In fact, we do everything by hand from okay. the very beginning to the end, whether it's peeling the fruit that goes into the gin or, mm-hmm. or labelling the bottles. It's all done by hand, and it will continue to always be done by hand. We might need more hands,
sure.
but we're very proud of the fact
yes.
that it's all done by hand. It means every bottle is made with a lot of love
sure.
and care, and you know, people have a product at the end that you know they've been a part of making, which I think is really powerful. I think it comes through.
Of course, I think your intention is everything actually when you're doing something. So
absolutely.
And I think you try and source local ingredients as well, isn't it right? That is it some
do.
Type of thistle or I don't know. I'm not
milk thistle.
Milk thistle. There we go.
To the South
okay.
Browns,
yeah.
And is reputedly a liver cleansing.
So that's the thing that helps well. with the hangover
absolutely.
Not being quite so bad.
I quite often challenge people that if they just drank Brighton gin of an evening, they wouldn't have a hangover.
Yeah.
We use super, super high quality ingredients.
Sure, sure.
And really high quality base spirit as well.
Okay.
And yes, it's also registered vegan.
So, okay.
And that means everything about the gin is vegan, even the glue that sticks the labels on.
Fabulous.
It, you know,
okay.
Whole
so it's really ethical.
Yeah. We want to make the most ethical choices we can. Mm-hmm. They're sometimes the expensive choices.
Okay.
But, you know, yes, we're trying to do the right thing.
So the business has obviously grown quite considerably, but yeah. ready to grow again by the sounds of things.
That's the plan.
Okay.
Yes.
And are you still looking for a distillery within the centre of Brighton itself?
Oh, yeah.
Or is that kind of impossible to find?
Well, it's not impossible.
Maybe someone listening might have an
exactly.
idea.
Exactly. If there are any guilty millionaires out there who've got a, you know, an empty mansion that they're quite... Yeah, I mean, obviously there are a few practical things we
okay.
need to consider. You know, and
what does one need for a, you know, a suitable
well, the
place?
Well, itself actually probably isn't as big as people might imagine.
Okay.
It's more about things like pallet access, really boring things.
Okay.
Like, can a lorry reverse in and
right.
pick up our gin and drive away again without forcing the whole of Brighton to come to a standstill?
Sure.
We'd love to do a, you know, a gin school and gin
yes, of course,
and,
yeah.
So yeah, if they, you know, a couple of million quid and a nice big old Regency building.
Dave, I think you
town.
Live in Brighton, don't you? You're,
yeah,
you're
yeah.
not prepared to offer
you
your dwelling.
Unfortunately, you know, I'm a
just
renter.
A millionaire.
you know, we're not all J.K. Rowling, you know.
yes.
But wait, surely, once your new edition of Gin the Manual
exactly.
comes out, Dave, I mean, that'll be no problem.
Oh yes, that'll sell millions. Thank you for the plug. Yeah, that's this year's job. Bringing the Gin Manual. Somewhat up to date.
Right, okay.
So many new gins have appeared over the past 2-3 years.
In yes.
fact, probably 2 weeks.
Including the Brighton gin.
Oh, yes, now we have a very beautiful
bottle sitting in front of me.
Bottle,
here.
Yes.
Brighton gin seaside strength.
Not that this is bribery in any way whatsoever.
Not
but
at all.
It's worked on me anyway, so
good.
Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, you've got the original Brighton gin
okay.
strength in your hands.
Right.
Dave has the Brighton gin seaside strength, which is our new navy strength.
Have you given him
gin.
A more bracing...
57%.
I will be braced.
Excellent. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing what Dave thinks. But
before or after he's had a few of these?
Both.
Yes.
We'll do a compare and contrast. But this one, yes, is going to work fantastically well in cocktails. It's a really...
Okay.
punchy, strong, bold flavour, loads of juniper, four times as much juniper.
Oh, right, interesting, okay.
So it's not just the same gin as
no,
a higher strength, it's a
no,
different
no, no.
botanical
it's,
mix.
Or well,
ratios, anyway.
Yes, exactly that. We would recommend it served with a nice wheel of lime, just to...
I think gin
well,
and
I
lime is fantastic.
Some limes in the back.
Excellent,
oh,
I can see the show degenerating rapidly.
Right now. Yeah, fantastic.
I think I'm sure I was somewhere where there was one of your stands and you were serving it with orange as well, and that was really good.
Yeah,
so I was quite surprised to see that.
Well, we use fresh orange peel mm-hmm. in the making of the gin. So putting a slice of orange not only looks really pretty, really lifts the citrus notes of the gin. And actually, at this time of year, if you can get the blood oranges,
oh,
they
lovely.
Look absolutely amazing. It's theatre in a glass without you having to do very much at all. So, yes.
All right, and that's really helpful, isn't it? Because you've also got a lovely look, and the kind of branding is very
all the
appealing.
Right things. Thank you. Well, it's the colour of the seafront railings.
Exactly.
We
yes.
wanted to really reflect, you know, Brighton. We love living in Brighton.
Brighton's sure.
A great city. I think all of us here,
absolutely.
Everyone listening would agree.
I'm sure.
To
yeah.
That. So we really wanted to produce something that reflected our love of living in Brighton and is the spirit of Brighton.
Okay. So, Dave, bringing you in again. I mean, Gin used to be known as Mother's Ruin, didn't it?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, which was, a carryover from the 18th century. It's still known as that, It was really interesting that when I first began doing gin tastings, which was back in the 1990s, the most common question I got at a gin tasting was, why does gin make me cry?
Okay.
And it just had this reputation.
So is this not true then? This is a kind of a legend that's grown up.
I really don't know. It just had this reputation about it. It was something that just made you feel dreadfully depressed.
And now, like you said, in the 18th century, I mean, it really was pretty grim. It was very cheap.
They made it very cheap, didn't they?
It was unrecognisable.
Water wasn't safe to drink.
It'd be very, very rough spirit, and then flavoured up with essence. If there was any juniper, it would be essence of juniper, sulfuric acid. I mean, all manner of things. Ooh, it was not a nice drink.
Enough to make you cry.
Yes, probably, yes. Yeah. Just the smell of the sulfuric acid.
It was a weird one. But, these days, I can't remember the last person that said to me, gin makes me cry.
Yeah,
it's now the celebratory spirit.
Absolutely, it makes me happy.
Which is what it should be.
It's just me, yeah.
When drunk in a responsible fashion.
Absolutely.
Well, so the life of a spirits writer, I mean, you, as you say, you're working on the new edition of Gin the Manual.
Yeah.
That's got a bit of the history, and then you also talk about the different types of gin, because, of course, should you wish to try them, there are other sorts of gin apart from Brighton gin. I mean, obviously, we're going to focus on Brighton gin here, but other gins are available. And then it's got some cocktail recipes and things like that.
The idea of the manual series, there's gin, there's whiskey, and there's rum so far, is that there's lots of great books out there which deal solely with the history or deal with maybe tasting notes, but they don't actually combine the two. Or when there is a tasting note, it doesn't actually tell you how to drink it.
So the reader
is still kind of left there going, that tastes nice, but what am I going to do with it? Very few people are going to be drinking neat gin. So what I wanted to do was just have a book that was kind of a user's manual.
I think that makes more sense. And it makes a really nice present, actually, because someone who's interested but they don't know that much about it, or they want to experiment a bit. I was really happy to see that you had the breakfast martini recipe in that, because I'd tried that before and I think it's great. And I flicked through it thinking, oh, it'll never be in there, but it was. That was good.
El Maestro's classic breakfast martini in there.
I think nowadays people, much like 10 or 15 years ago, people might have had a whiskey collection, whiskey collection, where they might have had 5, 10 or 15 bottles in the cupboard. People didn't have that many gins in their cupboard 10 years ago.
There were sort of bog-standard absolutely.
And it's really, books like Dave's are really helpful and important, so you can actually experiment with different flavours and different...
And it was interesting during the tasting. I've never had different gins, one after the other sort of thing. And they were really different. And also depended on what mixer you put with them and everything else. But there is a real difference.
There's something for everyone.
Absolutely. And part of what I do in the book is not just taste it neat, but then everything is then tasted with tonic water. Everything's tasted with Sicilian lemonade, which is kind of the nearest to bitter lemon. But then everything was mixed as a martini. And everything was also mixed as a Negroni, but different ratios in the Negroni.
Ellie's getting excited here.
The fascinating thing is that out of the 120 odd gins in the book, there were very few that worked absolutely brilliantly in each.
Okay.
Some that are great gin and tonic drinks.
So they're sort of specialists
almost, yeah. Some are great
Negroni gins,
some are great martini gins. But so you can really, just by building up a portfolio of gins, you can actually find the gin for every occasion.
Yeah.
See, the word portfolio, that's lovely, isn't it? Because it's not just that you're an old lush and you've got too many, gins in your cupboard. Actually, you can have a portfolio of gins, and that's much better.
And also spreading it out to... what I find really fascinating at the moment, it kind of comes back to Brighton as well, because gin has become a celebration of the local. Mm-hmm. So gin is kind of the first international spirit. It was made with imported ingredients initially. Uh-huh. Now there's a great celebration of the local, so using botanicals which grow nearby or around. So you'll find Japanese gins using Japanese botanicals or Nordic gins doing the same. There's a great revival, thank goodness, in Geneva, which is the original style of gin, which is the
and
Dutch
that was
style,
Dutch, was it? Yes,
which
I was going
to
say.
Fundamentally different to the way that we make gin over here.
Okay.
And it's just absolutely phenomenal. So I think people's minds are expanding.
Absolutely.
As to what gin can be. but it has to taste of juniper.
Yes.
It gets me really, really annoyed when people bring out gins.
And
they don't taste of juniper because you're making a flavoured vodka, you're not making a gin.
So, sure.
I'm applauding. Yes.
Okay. And so, so we've got the new edition of Gin the Manual coming out. And Ellie, you've got these new editions of Brighton Gin.
Well, yes.
What else is on the horizon apart from a donation by a guilty millionaire of your new new distillery?
Well, as I say, we've started off our exports to Germany and Denmark, and we'd like to increase. There are some markets that are absolutely saturated. The Spanish market, for instance, they make a lot of fantastic gin themselves.
Right.
I personally don't think much point in us trying to keep vlogging Brighton gin there, but there are perhaps smaller markets that might suit us better, maybe Finland or and the Caribbean. Yeah. For instance.
That was on your holiday checklist, was it?
Crying out for
absolutely, yeah.
And you are now an award winner, aren't you?
I think at the last count, I think Brighton gin has now won 20, definitely 19.
That's pretty impressive.
And I think we can now talk about, I think it was embargoed, but we can now talk about the fact that Lux magazine have named us the handcrafted gin of the year.
Fabulous.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're really pleased. And obviously we've always thought we've made a great gin, but it's absolutely
it's nice to get the recognition.
I think so too.
And what kind of difference does that make to the business, seriously? I mean, it kind of changes the way that perhaps other people in the industry look at you and puts you into a slightly different league.
I think it probably does. And I think it depends largely where those awards have come from. They mean different things to different people.
Of course, yeah.
We've won several at the International Wine and Spirits Competition. That's fantastic because, the clue's in the name, it's international.
Sure.
And actually that's really valuable to be able
to get global recognition.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But again, local awards are equally as gratifying for us because, we, as I've said, we live and love living in Brighton. Mm-hmm. And, Kathy is the brains behind this gin. This was her idea, and she has worked tirelessly for the last 6-7 years to really make this work. So for her to have some actual recognition is really important for all of us, and very well deserved.
Yes, sure.
She'd be kicking me if she was here. Oh, shut up.
Well, it's quite good. You can blow her trumpet much better than she would her own.
Exactly, yeah.
And Dave, because I know that you know these guys as well, but what do you... I'm not suggesting anything untoward at all. I just meant maybe socially as well, in a sort of drinky social sort of way. How important do you think it is for a local company? I mean, you mentioned the fact that, local gins becoming more local and it's perhaps getting a little bit more flavour, a bit more character as a result. How important do you think it is that companies like Brighton Gin start to come to the forefront now? I mean, is it making us change our buying habits, perhaps?
I think so, I think people are fascinated by the idea of provenance and mm-hmm. buying locally.
Sure.
And wanting to support local businesses.
Yeah.
But also, I would say people... the flip side of that is that because there's so many gins available, people are now able to go, it might be local, but it has to be of good quality.
Mm. Sure,
So that is also...
So there's choice as well.
That's a very important element in mm-hmm. people's choice. But I think it's very important, and that's what the 21st century spirits, whether it's gin or rum or whiskey or whatever, are going to be increasingly important in terms of understanding where they come from and how they relate and interact with a community, whether that's a rural community or a city or whatever. And the idea that Brighton can have a distillery is just brilliant.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah.
So rather than gin being made somewhere, nobody really knew where gin was made. It was just made in
It seems much more impersonal, doesn't it?
Suddenly, it's part and parcel of a community. It's ours. It's got the the label is there, the colour is there.
Yeah, no, it's great actually, isn't it?
And what I love about Brighton Gin in particular is the way that the city really got behind it.
Exactly.
Really from the word go, it's like supporting supporting the seagulls.
It's got to be done.
It's the same manifestation of civic pride.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be replicated all the way around the country.
Mm. Of course,
as long as the gin is of good quality.
Of course.
I think that's fantastic news.
And you live and work. I know that you travel quite a lot also with your work, don't you? But you choose to live in Brighton as a writer, particularly a spirits writer. What are the advantages of being Brighton based?
Well, I mean, it sounds strange. The advantages of being Brighton-based are being able to get out of Brighton.
Okay. When necessary,
because,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, a lot of the industry is still based in London, so okay. Getting up and down to London's important. I travel a huge amount, so getting to airports is quite important. Right. I go up to Scotland a lot, obviously, you know, just because I'm from Scotland.
Yeah.
Of whiskey. So all of that, links are important, mm-hmm. In that respect. But also one reason that we've stayed in Brighton is because it's just a great place to live. And it's, you know, being able to sort of get up in the morning and go down to the sea and walk along the sea and get your head clear and actually be able to relax and actually think. I find it a great place to be creative, to be perfectly honest.
Well, that's interesting, and that's what I was getting at, really, because it strikes me that it is a hotbed of creativity, Brighton, isn't it? For whatever reason, it's something in the water, whatever it is. But it's really interesting how businesses with character, kind of quirky businesses, and businesses that have a lot of passion and a lot of pride in being local and being, seem to do so well here.
I think it attracts a certain type of person. I don't know, there's something in Brighton that seems to approve of small scale.
Yeah,
business.
I think so. And as you said, the community got behind Brighton Gin, and that was a good example of
and
how
also,
that can happen.
And also, it's small enough so you make connections.
Yes.
So that, you know, if you're in one area, so if you're in music, you will still know somebody's making gin and whatever.
Sure.
So
there's a kind of cross pollination, I guess, of
constantly. Yeah. So I think the idea of, you know, the kind of silo thinking, well, you're a distiller, therefore you're over there.
Yeah.
So you're not involved in any sort of creative world. You're not involved in a creative world at all. That's gone. You know, you're all part and parcel of this, the same creative community. And
which is great. It's very exciting.
That also then writing kind of taps into all of that as well.
Okay.
So it's just a great place to live.
So how can people, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you, Dave? I mean, obviously they can go into, will the new edition of Gin, the manual, be available in local bookshops? Will it online?
It won't be available until next year.
Okay. However, the original version is still
the original
selling,
version,
yes.
Thank you very much. I'm going to say that. The original version, which is a lovely new cover, is still available.
Well, I've got my signed copy. Yeah. I didn't bring it with me, but you know, you've already signed it for me.
I would heartily recommend you support your local businesses. So City Books, are fantastic. So go on to City Books. They've got all of my books in there.
And will you be doing like a sort of special signing, come tasting of the new edition?
Yes,
I think. It would be rude not to, really. I hope you'll remember Radio Reverb in your...
I'll be doing other gin events over the year, other drinks events over the year. So, yeah, just stay tuned.
Okay, and what's the best way to, because you've got your own website, have you? What's the best way for people to find out about you?
My outlet these days is actually scotchwhiskey.com.
Okay.
So you can get me dave@scotchwhiskey.com.
All right.
And yeah, I'm on Instagram as Dave Wasabi.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long story. It's a good story. It's a long story. And
yeah. Yeah, okay.
And, so you can see various photos and contact me there as well.
All right, perfect. And Ellie, what about you? I mean, you've told us a little bit about what's happening, but what's next?
Well, it will be about solidifying our UK market. Mm-hmm. You know, we're very, very proud of how many people are drinking Brighton Gin.
Yeah, and what
Brighton.
You've achieved so far is
Absolutely.
Pretty remarkable, really.
And thankfully that, you know, we've got a map on our website, actually, mm-hmm. where you can see...
What's your website?
BrightonGin.com.
Brighton, oh, that's nice and easy. Okay.
Yeah, so everything is there, our story, and you can buy things. And mm-hmm. yeah, and you can look at our lovely map, which, you know, obviously there's a big splodge of dots around Brighton and Sussex. But actually, very pleasingly, that there are quite a few dots.
And this is the people who supply.
The people who are selling Brighton Gin.
Yeah, right.
So that has spread. We're listed with quite a few of the big national wholesalers now. So it's about, you know, Dave's absolutely right. You know, there are fantastic gins all over the country, and mm-hmm. we celebrate that. You know, the more the merrier, as far as we're
yes,
concerned.
Of course.
It's really great for the industry. But we also really like it when Brighton Gin is being drunk, you know, in places further afield. It's on the bar at Dr. Fern's Gin Parlour in Hong Kong, at the Atlas in Singapore.
Oh, wonderful.
And there was a lovely lady this Christmas who got in touch and said, I'd love to buy some Brighton Gin for my partner, but I live in the Shetland Isles. And we will get your Brighton Gin to you. And sure enough, we did. And I really like the idea of, you know, our
one person in a boat chugging along.
Absolutely.
Sort of, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, exactly, with their Brighton Gin.
Excellent.
Yeah, watch this space. We'll hopefully, world domination.
Well, of course, that's a That's the next step, obviously.
We would love it if Brighton Gin was the go-to handcrafted gin globally. You know, aim high and we'll see where we get to.
I think that's perfectly reasonable.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, both of you, for coming on.
Thank you.
So I'm here now with my next guest, Bella Merrifield. And Bella, you came along today on rather an interesting mode of transport. Would you? I think there's a clue there as to what
I did,
you do.
Yes,
tell us about your company.
The creature that I've brought with me today. They've become alive to me now.
Okay,
I don't drive a car, but I can see why people name their cars now. So yes, what I brought with me was a black Inokim scooter. It's electronic. I brought along the original model, but we've got it's called a Light, and we've got Light 2s now. It's an Inokim electronic scooter.
Okay. Yeah. So this sounds like an interesting business. I mean, are they actually legal, these? Are they legal for road use? What's the deal with that?
I call it a grey area, and there's only one reason for that. And I mean, people, you've probably seen more of them over the last year, particularly the last year in the UK. We opened our shop in London 2 years ago, and we opened it knowing full well that in the UK, anything without a pedal is not road legal. It's a grey area because I ride them to work, from home to work.
I was going to say, because you yourself, you've been riding past police cars.
We've got a really small team, and we all ride them everywhere, in London and in Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
The owner of the company rides them much further afield than that, because he travels a lot for the business.
Right.
And none of us have any trouble, you know. Okay. The one thing I would say is when I'm, you know, when I'm driving it at rush hour, I get police jeeps pass me by, and they'll slow down. They will slow down to, I assume, to check that I'm wearing a helmet, which
of
I
course,
am,
yeah.
That I'm on the left side, that I'm in a cycle lane, that I'm driving responsibly, and they carry on driving. They've never stopped me. So,
okay.
So it's something everyone needs to consider. It's something I always tell every single customer that comes.
Well, I guess it's being responsible, isn't it? A responsible retailer.
It's something you have to know. I mean, you need to know it. Even if they don't ask me, I'll tell them. Because it's not illegal to buy it, it's not illegal to sell it, and you can use them on private land, no problem.
Of course, yeah.
But because the law is from the 19th century, I think it's from 1835, and it says if your
possibly
horse
needs
and
a
carriage
bit of updating. Yes,
if your horse and carriage doesn't have a pedal, you cannot drive it on the road or the pavement.
Okay,
that's what the law is. But of course, you know, we've sold over 900 in the UK now,
so it's
and
a
no
growing
one's having any issue.
No, of course. And tell me about the kind of eco features of it. I mean, obviously, it's a very eco-friendly.
It's extremely green. It's for us, and there's only four of us in the Inokim UK team. And to us, it's the only answer for inner city transport.
Oh, yeah, right.
Because it's completely electronic. You get it home and you can charge it. I mean, people charge them on trains. You just plug it into the mains like a laptop.
Brilliant.
And when it glows green,
and
it's
very light,
charging.
Isn't it? I mean, you shifted
some
it into the office next door,
yeah,
and you
I mean,
know,
I'm
well,
a
that's
bit
a problem.
Of a weakling, you know, I don't work out. I certainly haven't been over Christmas, so.
So it's just building your upper arm strength slightly, but not too much.
I'm used to them now. I think you know, after sort of a little while of using them, you get used to the different weights. So the Light 2 that I have is about 13 kilo.
Okay.
So definitely liftable.
So it's eco-friendly. And how long do these machines last? Is there a time period
they
that...
They do. It's interesting because people weren't asking us about this very much at all.
Sorry, am I asking all the tricky questions?
No, not at all.
What the listeners might want to know about them.
Of course, and they do. That's absolutely the questions they're asking now is not just, how fast do they go? And what, you just plug it in? How much is it?
Okay.
They're not asking just that anymore. They're saying, these lithium batteries.
Yes.
Because now it's been in the papers a lot more, and now that we've had a lot more coverage, and it's in the news far more often about these things now, because they're more present on the road.
So they last for, the battery charge lasts quite a long time. It's easy enough to recharge.
They've got a decent life of about 5 years. We've known some to go on for 6-7 years.
Sure.
So at that point, you can bring it back to the shop, we'll change the battery for you, and it's very affordable.
And presumably they don't need an awful lot of maintenance. There's not so many parts that can go wrong.
No, I think with like any vehicle, they do need some maintenance, but
not nearly as much as a car.
Yeah, I mean, I've only
really
been
sure.
in this industry a shorter amount of time than my colleagues, but I mean, I found that, you know, the amount of time I've been there, people are coming in with other brands of scooters.
Yes.
There are other brands available, and they're very good. But they're maybe £200-300. Our lowest end scooter is about £590.
Okay.
for the smallest.
So they're kind of they're a premium product. They're built to last.
They're really well built, and they're a lot more durable. Scooting Limited, which is the name of the company, we're the only scooter company in the UK that offer, or that I know of, that offer full services and repairs. So much like if you buy a car, you don't want to drive it away, find that something breaks, because inevitably these things happen.
Sure, yeah.
And then there's no garage anywhere that can help you at all. So we're very happy to offer that, because we're getting endless people who've bought other brands who want us to fix theirs, and they can't take it anywhere. So it's an important thing to offer.
So you can help with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And what were you doing before this? Because you were saying that you're quite new to this industry, but you've always been interested in sort of tech and stuff, haven't you?
I'm like an iguana or something. I've just been, completely bizarre career path so far, but I've been managing across a few industries for the last 10 years.
Okay. And what makes you do this now? I mean, you know, obviously that's quite a departure.
It is from what you were saying before. You know what, when I was 23 years old, I started to, as a lot of young women might find that they want to, try and do something that really means something.
Yeah, okay.
actually helps the world, actually helps people.
All right. So this is more in line with your kind of interests and passions.
And I was in catering management for a long time because I loved cooking, I loved food. And I loved making people feel good, making kind of a nice home, all those things, making people nice food. But when I was that age, I left catering management to work for Amnesty International.
Because
I really wanted to do something.
Like that.
And I felt like between doing that in Bristol all the way till ending up in a chair in front of Itzik Ben Aharon, who owns Scooting Limited, and having a 2-hour long conversation with him about these completely bizarre modes of transport.
Yeah.
I felt like there was some synchronicity with ending up where I am now.
And what do you like about actually, you know, using your little scooter?
Yeah.
What's the attraction?
Driving force between me.
Excuse the pun.
Yes, of course. There was a driving force, and it sounds, I don't want to bring the tone down. But when I lived in London, I read a newspaper article that was so upsetting about the pollution in the city.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it was just a brief interview with a doctor who was working nights in a central hospital, and that he said he couldn't believe that the news wasn't reporting about it more, but there was an awful lot of very unwell children with asthmatic problems.
Okay.
And all this pollution was causing kind of like a, you know, all these germs and all the, you know, it was all creating this new type of asthma. And
absolutely.
As someone who suffers from asthma, it just really shocked me.
So your products just don't, you know, they don't add any problems at all.
Yeah, brilliant. To us, it's the only brand we're currently stocking, and we could stock so many others.
But this is
the only one we're going to go for.
That you believe in, yeah.
Yeah, we think it's the best. It's the best made, the only reason we're going for green transport is because we feel it's the answer.
Well, makes sense to me. I think that's very sensible. And, you know, good for you. It's a wonderful, wonderful concept, really great product. And where can people find you? Whereabouts is the shop?
So we've just opened about 5 months ago now, on Western Road, number 129.
Okay.
Western Road, and it's right by the big Waitrose, and there's the lovely Mad Hatter Cafe.
Okay.
Those guys, and we're just next door to them. So
brilliant. And there's a website as well, I'm sure. So what's your web address?
So we're sort of England's supporting team for InnoKim. So it's InnoKimUK.com.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Bella. And I'm sure you'll be scooting off, obviously avoiding all the traffic jams and everything on your way back to the shop. Nice way to travel, to commute, and
it's a nice
product to be involved with. Yes. That's absolutely fantastic. Okay. Thank you so much for coming in
to talk to us.
Thank you.
Radio Reverb. 97.2 FM. Radio Reverb.
You're listening to the Brighton Business Show on 97.2 FM with Vivian Smith. You can listen to or download the podcast on iTunes or via the Brighton Business Show podcast. And my next guest today is Charlotte Olfrey from Metro HR. Hi, Charlotte. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
Okay, and you're a Sussex-based company as well. I know that you do a fair amount of work in the Brighton area as well.
I do, yes.
I know you do all sorts of things. You help companies in all kinds of ways. So can you just give me a brief overview about HR before I ask you about yours?
Okay, so if we go right back to basics, I help small businesses manage their human resources. Now, that's quite broad, so that can include things like a basic framework of contracts and policies and procedures, manage and set expectations around how the business will run and how they will sort of manage their people within the business.
Sure.
Right through to very complex sort of employment relation issues where perhaps there's a disciplinary situation where a company might need
some help.
Oh,
and we all dread those,
yeah,
don't we?
We all
yes.
dread those, yeah. And actually grievance situations as well where perhaps somebody is unhappy in their role or unhappy with an element of their role or the relationship they have with someone.
Okay.
And we might have to investigate and consider what the problems are and, you know, what resolution we can put in place to sort of bring everybody back on track.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of businesses, particularly smaller businesses, are really worried about, perhaps they ignore it altogether because they feel, well, they don't have the budget for it. You know, if they go to one of these big HR companies or get someone in, sort of employ them permanently, that they're going to be not able to afford it and also it won't be applicable. But I think, you know, you offer quite flexible support, don't you? And why do you think that's important?
I think it's really important because one of the biggest concerns for small businesses is where do you get to the point where actually you're spending an awful lot of time on your human resource activities, which, let's face it, aren't revenue generating.
Sure.
And it's taking up a lot of your time, and actually you might need to get somebody or some help, somebody in place or some help. What's the point at which you need to make that decision? Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of businesses wrangle over the decision making and the cost.
Sure.
So one of the main concerns is looking at what the needs of the business are in the first place. So it might be that actually with some very simple interventions and techniques, such as a good policy framework, some contracts, and somebody in the background to provide some advice, you can potentially survive a little bit longer without having to put a permanent resource in place.
Okay, so there are sort of degrees that you can go down, if you like, in this respect. And I think you were telling me earlier that there's this tribunal insurance as well. How can that help a business?
It's something a lot of companies don't consider and don't know a lot about.
Because everyone's scared about being taken to a tribunal, aren't they? Because,
yeah,
I mean,
they are.
Presumably it can bankrupt a business if not managed
and in
properly.
In my experience, I've seen an organisation, a very small charity, that were taken to tribunal, and they did have some tribunal insurance, which did cover the cost. But the cost of the tribunal were around £80,000.
Wow.
And I think the CIPD, which is my professional body that I belong to, they reckon that a CIPD average tribunal cost is sort of $7,000-$8,000 for a very small business. And that's a big chunk of money.
It certainly is. Yeah. And something that, you know, no one wants to be in that situation. But these things happen when you employ people, don't they?
They unfortunately do, because the one thing we are dealing with is human emotions. And also, I mean, particularly in the Brighton area, which is very entrepreneurial, we have a lot of startups in the Brighton area.
Yeah.
So they
start up. So potential explosive situations.
So they take on staff and then find that perhaps things aren't quite going the way they thought they might go.
Right.
And then they perhaps have to let staff go, or they have to refigure the staffing complement to actually future-proof themselves. And perhaps what they needed in the beginning isn't what they need now.
I understand. So, you can help these businesses to kind of, as you say, future-proof the business, but think about what comes next. What if, you know, because obviously you've seen all these potential scenarios play out in real life, I guess. So you can give them some advice in those terms.
It's quite interesting, because if I say to small businesses, well, let me help you set up an HR strategy, they can become quite overwhelmed by that. That's quite a big thing to talk about, because when we think about strategies, we think about long-term.
Sounds very grand and global
and
yes,
and long-term. Actually, a very basic, simple HR strategy could be to make sure you've got the right people in the right jobs doing the right things.
Yes.
You know, in the way that you need them to work that fits your business. And as I keep saying, I'll probably say it a number of times, a good set of policies that manage expectations and behaviour on both parts, the company and the employees.
Sure.
Some really good employment contracts that mean if you do need to negotiate out of them or you do need to make changes, that the terms are set in the first place and we can work from those. That's a basic strategy.
Yes, because I think strategy sounds like one of those business speak things sometimes, doesn't it? People think, oh, I don't know what that is. Is that part of my vision? Is it what is it? But and I think you know, we've spoken before about how people often think, well, you know, I'm friends with this person I've employed. I don't, you know, we've got a verbal understanding. You know, we're not going to fall out. But that's really dangerous, isn't it? To take that view.
It is really dangerous. And actually, going back to this idea of Brighton being very entrepreneurial and having a lot of startups, when small businesses first start out, very easy to fall into a trap of being good friends, starting a business and embarking on this activity together in a very casual, friendly way. But as the business grows and then you bring more team members in, there needs to be a little bit of structure.
I suppose agreement as well as to who's responsible for
roles,
whichever role.
Responsibilities. Who's responsible for what things within the business.
Yeah.
And accountability.
Yes.
And if it's too casual, you can lose sight of that accountability. And actually, you can set yourself up with a business culture that you perhaps can't carry forward as you grow.
Sure. So it might have been suitable initially, but as the company grows, it's no longer effective or no longer working.
Absolutely. And as with any strategy, it's subject to change.
Yes.
You know, your needs might change. The requirements of the business might change. Mm-hmm. Your funding, your available resources might change. So you really do have to look at the bigger picture. Mm. And sometimes you have to make some tough decisions to future-proof your people plan and make sure that you've got the right people doing the right things to actually help you grow your business. But not only that, look after your staff. Because if you look after your staff well and you do have some good parameters for a good working relationship that you set up from the word go, then actually your staff will help you grow your business.
Yes, and you want them on side. I mean, you know, as we were talking about tribunals earlier, we do obviously never want to be in that situation, but you want to make sure that, as you said, that the expectations are managed, everyone's very clear about, you know, what the job involves, what it entails, what's expected of them on both sides, I guess. And company culture, I know, comes into that. I mean, we're all perhaps a lot more aware after, you know, various events that have happened in the States and elsewhere about what's acceptable, what's not acceptable behaviour amongst colleagues or perhaps bosses and employees. But even though we've got a little bit more awareness, there are some things that just still are going on that aren't acceptable. Isn't that right?
It is right. I mean, the difficulty we have is that everybody's different. We all have different personalities, we all have different sense of humours, and we all have different levels of tolerance as well.
Because that old word banter, I mean, that must make you nervous, doesn't it?
Banter is a really interesting word, and it's something that I often have to define for people in the context of their own organisations, because actually even the definition of banter is different depending on the organisation.
Of course, yeah.
So, I mean, for example, if you have a warehouse and it's commonplace that people play practical jokes and people swear,
you
can't then chastise somebody for swearing, because that's banter within the
And it's always
of the,
been
of
this
the
way sort of thing, yes.
That's how it's always been. Whereas in other organisations, that's absolutely not the way we do things. So you do have to consider the definition of banter, and it causes a lot of upset, because someone's banter towards
somebody
else
is deeply offensive to someone else.
Offensive.
Yes.
Yeah. So you know, levels of tolerance are really different.
Do you have to write? I was thinking, you know, I'm familiar with dress codes and stuff like that. Do you literally have to, or have you had to, draw up behaviour codes or codes of conduct that are acceptable within a particular company culture?
Yeah, it's something you can look at.
Yeah.
I mean, when I talk about policies and procedures, I mean, some clients and some companies don't like to be too policied and too framework based, and I completely understand that. It doesn't suit everybody, but it can give you a good framework. And again, it depends on the business. because it might be that you have a very specific uniform code in your business because you are, you know, you have staff that are customer facing and providing a high end service or something where you really do need them to meet those high standards.
And there's a unified front that's presented.
Yeah,
approach.
Other businesses can be very, very casual. You know, you hardly ever see visitors. They're always out on site, which means they can change their attire accordingly.
Okay, yeah.
And workplaces are becoming much, much more flexible, which is great, particularly around dress codes and also around flexible working, which is really, really good.
But also slightly confusing, I'm guessing.
It can be confusing.
Because there's so many grey areas or blurred lines.
Yes, yeah.
And I mean, do you, I know that you're very flexible in how you work because a lot of HR companies, you know, people get signed up to a 5-year contract and, you know, and then there's no kind of room for manoeuvre. But do you occasionally, I think I'm right in saying that you occasionally go in as a consultant, even where there is an HR, in-house HR manager. I mean, can you then provide the sort of specialist support to do with a particular matter, a particular issue?
Yeah, the beauty of HR consultants, and there's quite a few of us around, is that we have very wide and varied expertise, and quite specialist expertise as well. So there's a number of ways that we can work with businesses. We can provide retained support, which means that they perhaps buy a set number of hours a month.
So as and when they need you,
ring. We you know, keep a timesheet and and bill them.
So peace of mind, really. I'm sure for them. Yeah,
so they can make a number of phone calls or send a few emails and say, can you check this or what should I do about that?
Mm-hmm.
And early intervention is really important, actually. Because it can change the shape of a situation.
Of course, and also the cost involved, I would imagine.
And then actually we can help with specific project pieces where we can support an existing HR team or an HR manager.
Okay.
And sometimes you'll find that something might happen within the HR team, so it needs to be given to somebody external because the internal HR team can't deal with it.
That makes sense.
Or they're included in allegations, so it might be that somebody raises a grievance and says, well, I put this to the HR person and they didn't deal with it in the way they should have done. So things can escalate and need to sort of come outside of the internal HR team. The beauty really of an HR consultant is the level of expertise they can provide.
Yeah.
So they can provide day-to-day support,
mm-hmm.
or we can actually provide very specialist advice and project support, you know, or just be there as and when needed. I mean, I have a number of clients who would just on a pay-as-you-go basis, they know that if they have an issue and it's not something they can handle, they'll just put a call out to me.
Yeah.
And I can, you know, if it's something that is looking like it's going to be a slightly bigger piece of work, then we can estimate how much that's going to cost and how much time is involved.
So it's all a little bit more manageable and less frightening, perhaps, for, you know, for a company to, you know, how long is a piece of string kind of thing. And I guess what they're also buying with you is somebody who is well up to date on current employment laws and guidelines, et cetera, et cetera. So they can be reassured that you know, you understand what the current situation is and what the current laws and rules are regarding whatever their issue is in the company.
I mean, that's my business, that's my job.
Yes.
So I have to make sure that I am absolutely up to date with current legislation and that I understand the legislation.
So you've done your due diligence on, you know, and which they can benefit from then.
Yes, of course. And I mean, you know, as individual HR consultants, we always carry our own professional liability insurance.
The other thing I was going to ask you about,
Of course, it's really important. And I've also registered with the Information Commissioner's Office as a under a voluntary scheme to be registered for data protection legislation.
Right.
That's really, really important so that I am trusted. You know, I'm a trusted advisor.
Yeah.
And of course, within our sector, we are members of the Chartered Institute of Personal Development.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a chartered member of the Institute, again, which carries its own code of conduct. And sort of rules of engagement, really.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, I would imagine that's the kind of things that people really want to know, that you're going to be able to cover all of that. You've got all that covered. And I know that you have a sort of like a sounding board trial, don't you? That people can perhaps if they're not sure about whether it's right for them or you know whether you'll be able to help them. So how does that work?
It's something that I put together through my website.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, I mean, HR consultancy is very much based on personalities.
Of course, yeah.
Because you know, not everyone gets on with everyone.
No.
And not everyone likes everybody's style.
Therein lies a lot of the problems, I would imagine, absolutely. That you come across anyway.
And I appreciate that even at my level. So
sure.
It's somebody that is looking to, or is perhaps thinking about whether they might want to engage an HR consultant as opposed to putting a permanent person in post.
Yes.
They can book a sounding board trial through my website, which is a 30-minute call. We can have a chat about either a specific HR issue that perhaps they've got bubbling and they might need some advice on, or just to generally chat through their HR needs.
Okay.
And it just gives us a chance to have a chat and sort of have a think about whether, one, it's something they might like to do. It gives me an opportunity to explain what I do, and also to give them a little bit of advice on the issue that they've come
and what they need, because I would imagine that this is, you know, I'm not saying it's a dark art exactly, but you've done a lot of work, a lot of studying in order to be able to give this advice. I would imagine often people are just unaware of what they need to put in place.
They can be. Some people are aware they need to address it, but it's one of those things, because it's not revenue generating, perhaps it just gets
it's
left
pushed
a bit.
To one side. Yes.
But yeah, definitely I can help any client that's thinking of maybe embarking on some HR support, help them look at what perhaps their immediate HR needs
are, because there must be a sliding scale of this is
absolutely.
urgent, you can't avoid this is should do if you can kind of thing, this is to do in the future. I would imagine you can give them that kind
there's
of
definitely
a,
some nice to haves, you know. You don't have to put everything in place all in one go,
but there must be priorities.
But there are some priorities and there are some key things, such as any new employee should be given a contract of employment within 2 months of starting, you know, to meet that legal requirement, to provide them with their terms of engagement.
And I guess there are also lots of rules about things like holidays and those kind of illness policies and those kind of things.
Yeah, so there's the statutory requirements, and of course then some companies will enhance those.
Yes.
So I can help a company look at their package and their offering to perhaps help them determine what they want to offer their employees and whether they want to enhance those statutory terms.
Yeah, because I'm imagining that actually it might turn into something that's of great appeal to potential employees. You know, this company really looks after their staff, you know, this is what they've got in place, these are the ways that they look after. So I think people sometimes imagine that HR kind of intervention is going to be a negative thing, but in fact you're there to make everything go more smoothly and to make people happier, teams happier and more productive, aren't you?
Well, I'd like to think so. And I mean, what you have to think about now is that as time has moved on and things have evolved in the world of business, very simply, actually there is now a thing around employer branding as opposed to marketing branding.
Yes.
And it is actually about being an employer of choice. If you are an employer that people want to work for, then you will get good talent, good people that will stay with you for the long haul.
Because they're inspired, they want to be part of your vision, etc.
Because you're offering them a good package and because you are looking after them.
And I think these days, you know, the world of work is far less secure than it used to be. And all of those factors are important, aren't they?
They are. And I think what's really interesting is that you can have now, I mean, in my age range, which will probably age me by what I'm about to say, but
surely not. Surely just over 21.
Where I'm probably going to be 67, 68 before I can retire.
Yeah.
And actually in that time, you can have several careers. You
indeed.
Know, you don't just have to have the one.
That's right. In fact, sometimes, I mean, I remember going to a talk at my son's school and they were saying that some of the careers our children will be involved in haven't even invented yet. We haven't even thought of a name for them yet, you know, and that's how fast things are changing, aren't they?
Well, they are. And also, you know, there's a lot of things in the HR sort of press at the moment about the rise of robotics and artificial intelligence and things like that. And it's really fascinating to read. But I always find what's most poignant about it is that actually you can't move away from the fact that there is emotion involved.
Of course.
In human, you know, human
of
resources.
Course. And as long as there are customers, there will also be people to talk to them. Yeah. And, you know, there is no way that you could do without people. So you better do with them and do well with them as well, I think.
Yeah. And we all like a level of direct engagement. We all
of
want
course.
To talk to a person. We all want to be sort of, we all want to think that perhaps we've been well looked after and well treated fairly and consistently.
And we've been able to make a difference and someone values us and all of those things. Yeah,
definitely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, I think we've covered some of the glaring mistakes that people make, perhaps, and in terms of not looking at their HR properly or not consulting anybody. Is there anything else that we've missed that you think is really important for companies to know, business people to know?
Well, I think if I could just pick up on the you mentioned the 5-year contract.
Yes.
I've come across a couple of clients recently that have signed up to, and I won't mention the name, but one very big HR provider.
Okay.
On a 5-year contract at quite a large sum a month.
Mm-hmm.
For just basic access to some simple policies and sort of template documents.
Okay.
I just feel that that's not very bespoke, and whilst it can fill a sort of tick a box that you have HR support, it's not going to be tailored to your business.
No.
And it's a very, very long time to be tied into a
contract. It's a lot of money if it's not anything particularly personal, as you say, to
Absolutely.
Your business.
Yeah. So I would say if you are going to look at thinking of outsourcing your HR or getting a consultant to provide you with some support, mm-hmm. have a really good look around at the type of support and the type of person that you want support
from. And you
from.
Want a little bit more of a bespoke situation, yeah,
you
don't
need
you?
To bespoke it to your business, and you don't really want to be tied in for 5 years.
No, because things change.
Things
You may have different requirements. You might need less HR involvement or more.
Yes.
So that's not really tying in with business growth or development, is it, if you have that situation.
It's not flexing with your business need. It's
no.
a constant cost that will be a fixed cost for 5 years.
Sure.
What you need to be able to do is flex the HR support that you need in line with your business strategy and how your business is growing, developing, moving.
And presumably that means you can review things and think, well, we need to change that or tweak that or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's a real shame to be tied in for that length of time.
Yes.
And it's just not particularly necessary.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I wouldn't want to sign any client up to probably even a 2-year contract.
No.
Because, you know, things change and things might just be different.
Sure.
And you might not need the same level of support.
And you would rather have that dialogue with them and sort of take the pulse or take the temperature of the business as you go along rather than just having a one-size-fits-all kind of scenario.
Absolutely. And businesses that are growing quickly or adapting quickly to their market and their environment, they can get to a point where they do then need an internal HR person.
Yes.
And I have supported a number of businesses to actually help them recruit that person.
Sure.
And then do some handover. So we make sure that the person they have in place is absolutely the right person for the role and is fully briefed on any work that has been done by me as a consultant.
So they're not coming in cold, they're coming into something that's been set up and designed for that particular company.
And then I'm still there in the background if they need extra support.
Brilliant, that's fantastic. So Charlotte, how can people get hold of you? I know that you're Metro HR. What's your website?
So my website address is www.metrohr.co.uk.
Okay.
And on my website there is the sounding board trial, which you can sign up for. There's also a fantastic HR checklist on there.
Yeah, I particularly like that. I think that's such a good idea.
So you can have a little look, print the checklist off, mm-hmm. Have a look and see how you're faring in your HR, because many business leaders actually have a good base understanding of HR. So they can have a look through and see, you know, what am I doing on the checklist that I what am I not doing that I should be doing? What am I doing mm-hmm. that's good? What do I need to improve on? And then that can form actually the basis of a conversation between us if they want to then.
So they've got the pointers, then they can take that a little bit further, find out a bit more detail from you. And I think that's such a great thing to offer people. And then, as you said, you know, people need to be comfortable with the way you work with them, etc. So that gives them a really, really great opportunity to find that out, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And my goal really is to help companies take their HR from being sort of simply functioning and plodding along to
something a bit more exciting,
really fantastic, and actually working for their business and helping them grow their bottom line. Because a lot of people don't always understand that whilst HR in itself is not a revenue generating activity within the business,
but the people are, aren't they?
The people are.
Particularly the happy,
and if they're happy people,
values
they generate
people.
More revenue.
Yes, of course. And I, as you say, people don't they often forget that element of it.
Yeah.
It's just one more thing. That's brilliant, Charlotte. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to me. And I'm sure there'll be lots of listeners who've learnt quite a lot, and they're now mentally going through that little checklist, thinking, what do I need? What do I need to do now? But that's really tremendously helpful. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. And obviously, if anybody does want to get in touch, then have a look at the website, and there's a contact me form on there.
Come aboard, sister. Radio Reverb.
I'd like to say a big thank you to the guests who joined me today. So we had Dave Broom, who is a spirits writer. We had Ellie from Brighton Gin. We also had Bella, who came on to talk about her company and the e-scooters that they sell. Fantastic as well. And we had Charlotte Alfrey from Metro HR. Thank you very much. This is Vivian Smith with the Brighton Business Show.